From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the failure of European unity, we talk with New York Times correspondent Craig Whitney. The area is in its worst recession since World War II. Unemployment is high. Foreigners seeking asylum in Germany are the targets of right-wing violence, and the fighting continues in Bosnia. Also, a film about South Central L.A. made by kids who live there. We talk with the film's co-director, Jim Chambers, and with 13-year-old Cleophas Jackson, who worked on it. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new summer series, The Building. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. A United Nations spokesman said today the UN is now in a position to use air power in support of the peacekeeping forces in Bosnia-Herzegovina. He said Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali has informed the Security Council. The United Nations announced on August 11th that all arrangements, including the deployment of forward air controllers, were in place for possible airstrikes, but the tests of the systems were being carried out. Today's announcement indicates those tests are now complete. At the Bosnia peace talks in Geneva, the three negotiating sides agreed to place Sarajevo under UN administration for up to 2 years, but that accord is only part of an overall peace plan that still has not been reached. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Geneva.
Today's agreement is called Appendix 2 of a peace settlement that still doesn't exist. It calls for a UN administrator to be appointed by the United Nations Secretary General, who will be advised by a committee of four Muslims, three Serbs, two Croats, and one representative of the district's minorities. Each of the open city's nine municipalities will organize its own police force on an ethnically proportional basis to be monitored by a large UN civilian police force. The accord also calls for a human rights monitoring mission and that refugees and displaced people have the right to return to their homes. But today's agreement will not be implemented until an overall peace plan is signed, in contrast to the Muslims' demands that Sarajevo be placed immediately under UN protection. And the peace conference spokesman said there has been no discussion of the number of UN troops needed to enforce the Sarajevo Accord. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Geneva.
Four people were killed today and several more wounded in a failed assassination attempt in Cairo. Egyptian Interior Minister Hassan El-Alfi only suffered minor injuries in the attack. A circuit court judge in Sarasota, Florida, ruled today that 14-year-old Kimberly Mays should not be forced to visit with her biological parents, Ernest and Regina Twigg. In his ruling, the judge said forced visits would cause the girl mental, physical, and emotional harm. Gary Grigsby of member station WUSF reports.
The judge ruled on the visitation issue, not on Kim's request for a divorce from the Twigs. He says the Twigs have no biological, therefore no legal standing in the case. An attorney for Kim's guardian says the issue of children's rights was served by the ruling.
It means that children aren't considered property by the courts in this county or in this circuit, and they have individual rights that need to be protected and that are recognized by the circuit courts of the 12th Judicial Circuit.
A legal struggle has ensued between the Twigs and the Mays over visitation ever since it was discovered about 5 years ago. Kim was somehow switched at birth in a hospital mix-up. The Twigs say they will appeal today's ruling. For National Public Radio, I'm Gary Grigsby in Sarasota, Florida.
Stock prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 18 points. This is NPR News. Government officials in Brazil said today wildcat miners working illegally in a remote part of the Yanomami Reservation have massacred 19 Indians. Four survivors of the mass killing in a Yanomami Reservation near Brazil's border with Venezuela walked out of the remote jungle and reported to federal authorities. Two helicopter teams searched for the massacre site unsuccessfully earlier today. A New York millionaire who spent nearly 2 weeks buried in an underground bunker spoke publicly today about his ordeal. Harvey Weinstein was rescued on Monday after police followed a suspect to the location where he was being held. Suzanne Sauceville has more.
After being buried alive deep within a cramped pit for 12 days, the 68-year-old chairman of the nation's largest tuxedo manufacturer told his story.
There were many times I did lose faith. I did lose hope. And I begged and pleaded as my captors take me out, to shoot me, and leave me on the road where my family would find my body and I could be buried properly next to my parents.
Weinstein credits his survival in part with techniques he learned in the Marine Corps. Weinstein was joined today by his family, Mayor David Dinkins, and members of the New York City Police Department who helped to rescue him. For National Public Radio, I'm Suzanne Sosville reporting.
A new study made public today raises questions about the usefulness of cardiac catheterization for heart attack victims. The procedure is a sophisticated test used in heart attack victims to determine the extent of their blockage. The study, to be published in tomorrow's New England Journal of Medicine, revealed that patients tend to get the test based not whether on whether it would be helpful, but instead whether the expensive equipment is available in the hospital. The research showed the test has little effect on the survival rate of heart patients. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. The Cold War is over, yet Germany and other European countries are besieged with troubles. Germans are trying to cope with the high cost of reunification while being hit with the worst recession in decades. Why is Europe in such a shambles now? It's a question we put to Craig Whitney, European diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. He's been with the paper for 25 years and has been bureau chief in Saigon, in Bonn, Moscow, Washington, and London. He's also the author of a new book, Spy Trader, about Wolfgang Vogel and the shadowy world of Cold War espionage. I asked him what hopes Germany had when the wall came down.
Unrealistic ones. I think they thought that Eastern Germany, the formerly communist part, could be quickly absorbed into West Germany, that prosperity would instantly arrive in the eastern part of the country, and that the West could do all this without having to do any heavy breathing. And none of that, of course, has turned out to be the case.
Would you say the country is experiencing a kind of identity crisis today because of the differences between the two Germanies?
I wouldn't say it's an identity crisis, but I think what has clearly emerged is that East Germany and West Germany had developed into two very separate cultures, which will take years, probably decades, to meld, and that the United Germany is something very different from just an expanded version of what we knew as West Germany during the Cold War.
Well, how would you say these two former sides view each other?
Well, To make a cliche out of it, as they often do, it's the Wessis are the people in Western Germany, and they tend, to, if we oversimplify a bit, to view the Ossis, the people in the East, as lazy, don't know what work is, think that everything should be served up to them on a platter at their expense. And the Ossis in the East think of the West Germans as overbearing, rich uncles who are a bit stingy and don't want to sacrifice anything to let them have a little piece of the good life that they've enjoyed for 40 years.
Any truth to the cliches?
Sure. I think the only way to overcome these cliches is for national leadership in the country to recognize that people have to be told what realities are and not lied to. I would fault Chancellor Kohl for having misled people back in 1990 by saying to both East and West, this is going to be a piece of cake, nobody's going to be worse off, and nobody's going to have to make any sacrifices. And what he should have made, in the view of people like one of his predecessors, former Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, is a blood, sweat, and tears speech along the lines of Churchill's at the beginning of World War II, telling people, look, this is a great accomplishment. Unification is the realization of a long-term dream that we've had, but it's going to take a lot of hard work and probably means that we in the West are going to have to give up some guaranteed annual benefits and annual increases in salaries and that sort of thing for a number of years so that our less well-off cousins in the East can eventually enjoy the same standard of living we do.
So are Germany's economic troubles, which are growing, tied then with the problems of reunification?
Certainly, they are in the eastern part of the country, and that $100 billion drain is there for the West. But what has really hit them hard on top of all this is the recession spread from the United States and Britain and other parts of Western Europe into Western Germany over this past year. So they're having to cope with this burden of unification at the same time as they're hit by the worst recession since the end of the World War II.
Has this recession hit Germany harder than France or England or any of the other European countries?
No, it's hit them less hard than France or England, but the Germans aren't used to unemployment of more than 3 million people. And it's not just maybe a short-term problem. What is happening in Germany today is sort of what happened to the United States in the 1980s in the steel industry, for instance, or the coal mining industry. These are high-cost industries in countries like the United States and Germany. And the competition from countries where labor is cheaper and the benefits that workers get are less extensive than they are in our countries puts Germany at a competitive disadvantage, maybe forever. I don't know if Germany will continue making steel beyond the 1990s. But it's not something the Germans are used to concede that a whole area of industry, which has been a mainstay of their country's economic welfare for, you know, a century, might just have to wither away and cede to cheaper competition from Eastern Europe and East Asia.
My guest is Craig Whitney, and he's the New York Times European diplomatic correspondent. We're talking about Germany, and I should add that he's also the author of a new book called Spy Traitor. Well, until July 1st of this year, Germany had a rather lenient immigration policy. Until recently, why were they so open to outsiders?
Mm-hmm. They didn't have a lenient immigration policy. They had no immigration policy. What they had that was lenient by international standards was asylum. Asylum, you could claim asylum in Germany if you got there and simply told the immigration authorities the minute you arrived, I want to claim asylum. Under the German practice and law up to last July, anybody could do this, and last year nearly 450,000 people did. Now, not everybody who's coming in was really able to claim political persecution or religious or racial persecution. A lot of people were just fleeing from bad economic conditions in South Asia, Southeast Europe, and so on. The Germans saw this as an abuse of their liberal asylum procedures. The problem, as you mentioned when you assumed that it was a liberal immigration procedure that they had, is that the Germans don't allow anybody to immigrate except ethnic Germans. And there's a debate going on in the country now that perhaps they ought to change that and at least, to a limited extent, give some people the possibility of becoming Germans. For instance, Turks who've lived there for 30 or 40 years and whose children have never lived in Turkey and who only speak German, shouldn't they have the right to be German citizens if they want to?
And is this an issue that's being discussed?
Yeah,
inside the country?
It's being discussed in the public realm. It hasn't yet got to the point of anybody formulating a bill to debate in Parliament, but the Germans recognize that they have a major problem. But this immigration problem was, and still is, a terrific one. I mean, we tend to read about the right-wing backlash against it, the extremist violence against foreigners that has gone on, partly as a result of these overwhelming numbers. There's no excuse for that, but the Germans have received, when we consider last year alone, 450,000 asylum seekers. Well, that's way, way beyond what any other European country does. And all they've done now is really brought their asylum procedures in line with those of Britain, the United States, and other Western countries.
You mentioned the right-wing backlash, and there certainly have been attacks on foreigners, some very violent attacks that have ended in actual murders. Why the increase? And I'm assuming that there is an increase on attacks on foreigners in Germany.
Well, the increase has paralleled directly those big numbers in asylum seekers. that we've seen, and that has risen from, say, 100,000 a few years ago, or less even, to 450,000 last year. I think it also has to do, the violence has to do with the recession, with the unemployment. There are lots of unemployed people out there today, particularly in East Germany, but not only there, also in the western part of the country, where people think they don't have a future, they'll never get a job. What are all these foreigners doing here? They're taking jobs away from us. That's not true. The foreigners who came seeking asylum, most of them aren't allowed to work, but that's what some of these poor and frustrated and maybe less well-educated Germans thought. And then, well, you get a couple of beers into you at night and think, let's go make trouble or scare the asylum seekers.
There are neo-Nazis and there are skinheads in Germany, just the way there are in other countries, including the United States. Do you think they're any more dangerous in Germany because of its fascist past?
Well, we do worry more about Germany because of its fascist past, certainly, but I don't think history repeats itself exactly the same way every time. That's not to say that I want to minimize this neo-Nazi threat. The Germans should take the laws they have on the books seriously, and those laws forbid the emulation of Nazi methods or ideas or the dissemination of those ideas. You can't even buy Mein Kampf in Germany because it's against the law. But in many cases, judges have tended to hand out rather lenient sentences against troublemakers who've committed acts of violence against foreigners. Some of the sentences were, 6 months or probation. I think it takes some more strict law enforcement. When these things happen, they should be dealt with more firmly and more concerted action by the government to discredit these right-wing groups when they do try to blame foreigners for what's happening. Then we won't have a repetition of the Weimar Republic years. And I don't think that we are in the Weimar Republic again in Germany in the 1990s.
Are some of these far-right extremist political groups gaining in popularity in Germany? Beyond the youth?
There is a party called the Republikaner, the Republicans, although my Republican friends in the United States don't like to hear the word used for understandable reasons. This party is not one that's been outlawed. It denies that it's a neo-Nazi party, but it's on the extreme right wing of acceptable politics in Germany today. And that one has made some gains in state and local elections in recent years. We'll see what happens in the national election the fall of next year or late part of next year. But in no case has this support gone above 10%. And I think historically, if you look at West German politics for the last 50 years, at times of economic hardship and strain, there's always been a right-wing potential of about 10%. And we always worry about it, and we should, but it hasn't ever gone beyond 10%. I would doubt that it would go even that far in the next national elections, but that depends on what happens between now and then.
Well, I want to pick up on some of those ideas, but first I want to take just a very short break. And my guest today on Fresh Air is Craig Whitney, and he's the New York Times European diplomatic correspondent. He's also the author of a new book just come out called Spy Traitor. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Craig Whitney, and he's the New York Times European diplomatic correspondent. Well, let's enlarge our conversation to include all of Europe. And what has happened to the efforts to work towards European unity? Where is that today?
It's in a huge moral crisis, I would say. The effort to spur European unity and make it to arrive at the day when we had European unity faster began after German unification in 1990, and it went too fast. They tried to point the way towards monetary and economic union and buttress the goal of political union in the treaty they signed at Maastricht, the Netherlands, at the end of 1991. And I think they went too fast. The recession made it impossible to meld the German, French, British, Spanish economies as fast as would be necessary to get to monetary union by the end of this decade, and as a result, they may not. And under the strain, I think they've lost their bearings, and they don't really see where they're going now. One of the first things they promised to do was agree on a common foreign policy, and immediately that fell apart over the issue of Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering, is it even reasonable to expect that countries could put aside old rivalries and nationalistic tendencies and local economic concerns to act as a unified economic force?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think the great accomplishment of the European community, and it's certainly undiminished, is it's hard to think of any conceivable circumstance in which France, Britain, and Germany would be at war with each other. And I don't think they've fallen back on that accomplishment. But what is very hard is to make a single economy and a single political entity out of countries with centuries-long traditions of their own, of independence, of different languages and legal structures and all kinds of differences. It just isn't as easy as it was to build the United States, and it wasn't that easy for us to build the United States. We forget that now. The issue of monetary union is fundamentally a political issue. Margaret Thatcher pointed that out years ago, that if you agree to have a common money, then you're really giving up a basic element of sovereignty in your country, which is, you know, the right to issue your own coin and decide what it should be worth. And that issue has been much more difficult to cope with for the Europeans than they thought when they signed the Maastricht Treaty 3 years ago.
Let's talk a little bit about Bosnia. Why do you think Europe has been so reluctant to get involved with the war in what was the former Yugoslavia?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't just say Europe. Why have we been so reluctant, too?
But it's in their backyard, so to speak.
It is in their backyard, but it's a war that wasn't of their making. I think we could sympathize with Europeans who don't want to send troops into a civil war situation whose causes are obscure to them and the outcome of which is highly uncertain. Sending combat troops into a situation like that could involve heavy casualties on the part of every country whose forces got involved in fighting there. That's why the United States doesn't want to send in ground troops. That's why the Europeans don't. The trouble is that if you don't want to do that, then you've got to come up with other ways of stabilizing the situation or preventing it from spreading in your own interest. And the Europeans have not succeeded in doing that. Nothing that the Europeans have done has deterred that kind of conflict, and it could arise in other parts of the former communist world unless we do find a way to deter it. So there's been a general admission, I think, by the Europeans of failure in their current policies. As a substitute for deterrence or intervention, what they've done is sent in troops under the UN aegis to carry out humanitarian missions. These troops, however, have become hostage to the violence. They can't prevent it or stop it, but they're there. One of the arguments going on now is that if NATO starts bombing Bosnian Serb targets, as it threatened to do at the end of July, earlier in August, then if the Serbs want to retaliate, they've got troops from France and Britain in the UN forces that they could start shooting if they chose. Mm. And so these humanitarian missions become hostages to violence.
Do you think, though, that Europe or particular countries in Europe are going to make a move, whether it's a move militarily or to increase the number of at least peacekeeping forces in Bosnia?
I don't. I mean, I think they all clearly hope that the fighting will stop. The Muslims will recognize their defeat by agreeing to some sort of negotiated solution. We'll probably have a UN presence in Bosnia for the rest of this century, certainly, to keep people from resuming the fighting once it does stop.
So they'll do nothing, is what you're saying, or nothing more than what they've already done?
That's right. I don't really believe that NATO is ever going to bomb there either. I'll believe it when I see the first bomb on its way down to the ground.
You think it's a mistake?
I don't know. I think it's one of a thousand mistakes that we've all made. The important thing is to learn from these mistakes and think, what can we do to prevent this horrible sort of situation from arising elsewhere, in Moldova, say, or between the Ukraine and Russia, or in the Baltics, in Azerbaijan, in Nagorno-Karabakh. There's plenty of trouble spots in the former communist world, and they all involve clashing ethnic or national interests, just as they do in Yugoslavia. And we've got to find a way, the world community does, to make sure that never again does it result in this kind of bloody conflict that we've seen in Nagorno-Karabakh and in Bosnia.
I'm wondering, and I realize you're not a diplomat, you're a diplomatic correspondent, but how you do, or how a country applies lessons from Bosnia, which are so idiosyncratic to the problems there, and apply them to Moldova or any of the other hotspots in Europe?
Mm. Well, I think, first of all, one of the lessons that we've learned in this past case is that we have no diplomatic or military instruments that have the credibility that the NATO alliance had during the Cold War with the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. The fact that NATO was there and had the military forces available to respond to armed attack by the Soviet Union, and that the United States was ready to go all the way to using nuclear weapons if it had to, deterred any attack. We had no attack by the Warsaw Pact on Western Europe for 40 years. So NATO never fired a shot in anger, but it was effective. You can't say that NATO has been effective in this conflict. It's had no effect at all on stopping the violence. How do we work with the Russians and others to make sure that NATO and other and the United Nations have more credibility, have more of a deterrent effect than they had in Yugoslavia? That is the question of how you organize a future security structure for all of Europe. And exactly how this will be done will probably vary from case to case, but surely it's something we need to worry and think about.
Well, thank you very much, Craig Whitney, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Okay, thank you.
Craig Whitney is European diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. He's got a new book about the world of Cold War espionage called Spy Trader. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoen with Fresh Air. Coming up, South Central L.A. through the eyes of children. We talk with Jim Chambers, co-director of the new documentary, 112th and Central, and with 13-year-old Cleophas Jackson, who worked on the film. Chambers and his crew went to Watts shortly after the 1992 L.A. riots and collaborated with school kids there to try to understand what led to the unrest. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Building, a new summer sitcom produced by David Letterman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A UN spokesman says that the UN is now in a position to use airstrikes in support of peacekeeping forces in Bosnia. According to the spokesman, Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has informed Security Council President Madeleine Albright of the United States. Earlier this month, it was announced that all arrangements were in place, but that testing of the system was underway. Meanwhile, UN officials in Bosnia say that Serbian forces are still encamped on a key mountain outside the capital, despite a promise to pull out of the area. Spokesman says the Serbian units are in remote areas and pose no military threat, but this is disputed by Bosnian government officials. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Sarajevo.
The UN spokesman here, Commander Barry Frewer, characterized the Serb units on Mount Igman as stragglers. Frewer said they had told UN soldiers patrolling the area they had not yet received orders to withdraw, but he claimed the Serb units are no cause for concern because they are few in number and do not seem to be deployed for any tactical purpose. In general, Frewer said the UN command here is satisfied with the Serb withdrawal. Bosnian army officers, however, challenged the UN assessment, saying there are at least 250 Serb soldiers on Igman, plus an unidentified number hiding in wooded areas, and that they do represent a military threat. The deputy commander of the Bosnian army today warned the UN forces here that if the remaining Serb units do not withdraw soon, the Bosnian army will attack them. And then, he said, the security of UN forces on the mountain could not be guaranteed. I'm Tom Gelton in Sarajevo.
In New York City, the Egyptian sheikh, some of whose followers have been tied to an alleged bomb plot and the World Trade Center explosion, says that he would be willing to leave the United States voluntarily if he can go to Afghanistan. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman is being held now at a federal prison while he fights a deportation order. Earlier this week, a federal judge denied a request that the sheikh be released from custody because, the judge said, the sheikh is considered a danger to the security of the United States. Sheikh Rahman has not been charged with any criminal wrongdoing, but some of his spiritual followers have been implicated in the plot to bomb several New York landmarks, including the United Nations. The U.S. Attorney's Office in New York said they are considering the sheikh's proposal to go to Afghanistan, and according to the Afghani prime minister, his country would welcome the sheikh. Rahman is an Egyptian citizen, but the sheikh likely faces imprisonment in Egypt because of charges that he incited a riot in 1989. The sheikh openly calls for the overthrow of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials added nearly 18 points to close above 3,600 for the first time. The Dow Industrials closed at 3,604.86. This is NPR News. Eastman Kodak has announced plans to do away with 10,000 jobs over the next 2.5 years. Spokesmen say these job cuts are in addition to 2,000 eliminated earlier this year. The company now has some 115,000 employees around the world, and the job cuts will occur throughout the company. Kodak hopes to save $700 million this year, $1 billion next year, and $1.1 billion in 1995. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has called for more troops in Somalia. In a report today to the UN Security Council, he said that a force of 3,000 peacekeepers is needed in order to extend UN activities in the nation. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
At present, there are over 20,000 UN troops in Somalia. This doesn't include the U.S. Quick Reaction Force, whose mission is to support the UN peacekeepers. But according to a new report by Boutros-Ghali, the number of UN troops will rise significantly, Already, an additional 7,000 are scheduled to take up positions between now and the end of September. But the Secretary General says an additional 3,000 peacekeepers are needed so that the UN can pursue its program of disarming the various factions in the central and northern regions, as well as to help restore security in Mogadishu. Their presence would swell the UN operation in Somalia to over 30,000 troops, making it the largest UN operation in the world. I'm Trevor Rowe in New York.
State Department officials have added Sudan to a list of nations accused of sponsoring terrorism. Under the label, the country is subject to economic sanctions, but at present Sudan receives very little U.S. aid. However, commercial sales of U.S. arms to the nation are banned, along with any technical information that could equip terrorists. Also, the measure requires Washington to veto World Bank loans to Sudan. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Less than a month after the fires died down from the rioting in Los Angeles, a group of actors and directors began working on a film to explore the roots of the unrest. To get a different perspective on what had happened, they went to a school in Watts and asked the kids to make the film with them. The kids who worked on the film range from age 8 to 21. They took cameras into their neighborhood and interviewed neighbors, gang members, business owners, and community leaders. The film, 112th and Central, Through the Eyes of Children, has just opened. The Los Angeles Times says it's a demonstration of the revelations possible when filmmakers just let people speak directly to the camera about their human predicaments, without the soundbite grabbiness of most of what passes these days for documentary footage. One of the directors of the film, Jim Chambers, is with us today, along with one of the filmmakers, 13-year-old Cleophas Jackson. When Chambers and the other directors first went to Jackson's school and told the kids they wanted to make a film with them, there was initially a lot of mistrust.
I didn't believe it personally, and some of my friends didn't believe it either, because it was the first time anyone ever came at us with anything like that, giving us an opportunity to make a film, do something that I always wanted to do, and make a change and be able to express yourself freely. We never had the opportunity, so actually we didn't believe it.
What did they say or do that got you to think this might actually happen?
What made me think is because they kept coming.
Uh-huh.
After the first meeting, they came again, and then we started to get to know each other, and they spent some time with us, and we really we started trusting one another, and from that time on, I knew that it was going to happen.
Can I interject?
Go ahead,
thing?
Jim.
I have to characterize that first meeting as very, very poignant and powerful. Yeah, I think a lot of us who worked on it might forget that first meeting, but we went down, we introduced ourselves, and then the oldest member of the students, Daryl Strait, said, like Cleophas, just alluded to, all right, we might consider doing this with you, but only if you get to know us, and only then, because we've experienced too much media rape, if you want to call it that. We've had too many news crews coming down, sticking a microphone in front of our face, turning on the charisma and the cameras, turning the cameras off and then leaving, and boom. They'd felt ripped off in that process. And so during the introduction of person to person to person, we heard stories coming out of the mouths of children 9, 10, 11, 12 years old about living through this L.A. crisis that was really the essence of the film. It turned into a much more formal effort, but we heard children just casually talking about dodging bullets and living without power and living not knowing where their parents might be because they were caught outside in the middle of the melee. And that really just set us on a track as filmmakers that said, all right, if you want to do this, you better be serious about it.
Let me ask you, Jim, about what some of the young people wanted to show and tell in making this film.
We worked with the students for about 6 weeks, very specifically in what we called our pre-production phase, in trying to draw out the stories that they really most wanted to tell. And it became apparent early on, just by leading discussions, what those areas were. So we just tried to clarify them and reiterate them. And by the end of 6 weeks, it was crystal clear. It was the five sections that Cleophas enumerates in the opening of the film. Art, the gang truce, relations with police, family issues, and the future. And those were as diverse and maybe interconnected or disconnected as those themes might be, those were the ones that were most paramount in their minds. And so we just set out as filmmakers, as a group, to stick to those and try to investigate them as best we could.
Well, let's take a very short break. And I'm speaking today with Cleophas Jackson and Jim Chambers, and they're both involved with a film called 112th and Central, Through the Eyes of the Children. It's a movie made by young people ages 9 to 21, looking at the roots of violence of the 1992 Los Angeles riot. Cleophas Jackson is one of the young people, he's now 13 years old, that worked on the film. And with us as well is Jim Chambers, and he's one of the co-directors of the film. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Cleophas Jackson and Jim Chambers, both of them involved with the film called 112th and Central, about the roots of the 1992 Los Angeles riots. Let me ask you, Cleophas, because what we see is you interviewing people on camera, and I'm curious how you prepared your interviews and how you thought about what you wanted to ask people.
Actually, I didn't too much think about it. I just went with
it. You just went with what you were feeling?
Yes.
We divided the film into five segments so that we could attack each of the themes. And each group had their own unit of youngsters and older filmmakers, if you want to call that. And Cleophas' group was co-directed by a man named Robert Walker, who has spent a lot of his adult years in the news media. And they would go out in the field for several weeks with Hi-8 cameras and conduct interviews. So by the time that he got on film, he'd been doing this for about 4 weeks, and he was ready.
Well, one thing I would say about the way that you seem to be a very natural interviewer, Cleophas, and there's one where you're talking to an Asian woman about prejudice and how she defines prejudice and how she looks at other people. Was that something that you thought about?
I thought about it because it always seems to happen. If you ask someone something like that, they tend to look at you funny.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll give you an answer, but most people, when you ask them on camera, they tend to shy away and don't give you an answer. But she was pretty straightforward with me.
Well, and
Cleophas, talk about the first time you met Angela Oh.
Oh, the first time I met her, I went to her office. And we were going to do an interview. With some people who were on the committee, but we didn't do it because it was canceled. And she wanted to interview, and we told her that we were going to interview her on the film. So she tried to interview me at her office, and she tried to get me kind of mix me up to see can she confuse me or catch me and get me in something that I couldn't get myself out of. Like, say different things, questions that she felt that I couldn't answer.
So you felt like she was trying to trip you up?
Yes. tried to play me out.
Why do you think she was trying to do that?
By me being a little kid, she wanted to see that I actually know what I was talking about. I did. What was it? Was I really good enough or ready to interview her?
And were you?
I was born ready.
Well, let's play a clip of that interview that Cleophas Jackson did with Angela Oh talking about prejudice.
Would you define the word prejudice for me?
Prejudice is when people have these ideas already in their mind about how you are or how I am based on just what they see, not knowing who the person is.
Do you feel that there's a lot of that going on in the world?
I think there's a lot of bigotry and prejudice in the world.
Have you ever been prejudiced?
Yeah, I definitely am prejudiced. I have my prejudices.
Of who?
White men. White, financially secure, slender, privileged men.
And why is that?
Because I think that all the rules are made for them.
Do you think that your race will ever have a future in L.A.?
Yeah, I know it will, because we're not going anywhere. All those people that keep telling us to go back home, we are home. This is our home.
Do you find, Cleophas, that when you're talking to someone on camera, you actually end up having a different conversation with them than you would if the cameras were turned off?
Actually, no. Me, when I get on camera, I tell them the things that I would on the same thing I tell them on camera, I would tell them off camera, because if I'm going to tell you something, I'm going to tell you the whole truth.
Jim, did you want to say something?
Just that the very first meeting we all had down at the school, we all went around and introduced ourselves, raised our hands, said our names and what we did, and Cleophas raised his hand and said, "Hi, my name is Cleophas Jackson. I'm 12 years old and I'm a community organizer." And the room stopped. That also took us in a different turn. We had gone down into a neighborhood that we'd never been to, and here we were in front of a 12-year-old community organizer. And we all looked around at ourselves and said, "We're in for something."
Cleophas, let me ask you how your neighborhood has been changed after the riots. What's different about it?
It's more empty. There's no... actually, any more stores. The stores that they are rebuilding are liquor stores. There's a lot of graffiti and trash in my community now. And the violence between the gangs had cooled down a little, but there's still a little violence. But as far as the people, it became a little bit better. But the community, it needs to be rebuilt and restored.
Cleophas, do you want to move out of your neighborhood?
I like the area I am now. I would like to get a house on a better street in my neighborhood. But actually, the hood is where I grew up, and I'm pretty used to it. I would just like to live in a better area. If that means leaving the community, then I guess I would have to. But I would just like to live in a better environment.
There's something you say at the end of the film, Cleophas. You say that when you grow up, you want to be an attorney general.
Yes.
Why?
It's because every time sometimes I look at TV and I read books. I read a book about Attorney General, I read a book. It was a book on the jobs of the executive branch, of the president. And I read a book, and to me, the most interesting job was the Attorney General's job. And I liked it, some of the things that the Attorney General got to do. It was like a lawyer for the state, but I would like to be an attorney general of the executive branch. they get to have other work with other lawyers for the state and make deals, but they have to consult with the president. But I think it would be a very interesting job, and I can probably bring about change if I do something, because it was the most, to me, it seemed like to me it was the most helpful job that I can possibly do.
You know, it sounds like you still believe in the system, and this is after the riots and after the King verdicts and all the other things that have happened in the last couple of years. Sounds like you still believe in the system.
Yes, I still have some beliefs in it, but they gotta come through. I mean, during the president, when people they were running for president, then they were making all these campaign promises. That President Clinton, he promised to bring about change. To be honest, he haven't really done any of that yet. But I think if we give him a little more time, he's going to come around. Hmm. I hope so.
What do you want for your neighborhood then?
Actually, in my neighborhood, I would hope that they be able to bring some jobs down there. I mean, I ain't talking about no factories. I mean, that cause pollution. I mean, maybe some construction company jobs. Where they be able to provide jobs for the community, maybe even build more housing in the community. That give the someone where it takes a lot of people to bring about a construction company, and you'd be able to hire a lot of people. Cause I know a lot of people in my community that had experience with construction but never went professional with it. That they can really help out and have big ideas. They just never had the opportunity to go somewhere with their ideas. So I think this should bring basically more jobs and more shopping plazas near the community.
Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us today in Fresh Air and spending the time talking with us. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Cleophas Jackson will start 7th grade next month. He worked on the new film 112th and Central through the eyes of the children, which opened in New York today. Jim Chambers is an actor, director, and dancer who is one of the directors and producers of the film. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us today to tell us about the show. It's mid-August, Noah. Any news today?
Well, it is a bit slow today, but we're still here. Tim Weiner, by the way, of the New York Times, has an important story about a possible Star Wars deception, a missile test, a missile hitting a missile, faked by the Pentagon, according to Weiner's story. The point was to deceive the Soviet Union, to deceive Congress, and to deceive the American taxpayer. From Star Wars to Airfare Wars, Linda Wertheimer has a discussion of price wars set off by pricing from Southwest Airlines. And Phyllis Crockett reports that the presidency of NPR has been offered to Delano Lewis of the CMP Telephone Company here in Washington.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. David Letterman's new talk show on CBS, Late Show with David Letterman, doesn't premiere until a week from Monday. But there's another Letterman show that premieres on CBS this Friday. It's a sitcom called The Building, and it stars comedian Bonnie Hunt as a woman living across the street from Wrigley Field in Chicago. Letterman doesn't appear in the show, but he's the co-executive producer. TV critic David Bianculli explained how that happened and has this preview.
Right now, David Letterman is an 800-pound gorilla at CBS. He can do pretty much what he wants. And one of the things he wants to do, even before his own new show launches, is to help out a friend and fellow comic, which, in a nutshell, is the reason something as quirky and different-sounding as The Building ever made it to primetime on CBS. Yes, it's only a summer series, but don't count Letterman or Bonnie Hunt out. Hunt doesn't just star in this show. She also wrote it, and the comic rhythms she sets up are almost completely foreign to what we've come to expect on network TV. It's a lot closer to the overlapping, stylized way they talk on stage at Chicago's Second City, which, not surprisingly, is where Hunt and a lot of this show's other cast members came from. Hunt plays Bonnie Kennedy, a woman who comes back to live with her friends at The Building after her fiancé cancels their wedding at the last minute. In this scene, her friend Holly, played by Holly Wartell, is helping her unpack, and they find Bonnie's wedding veil.
I got this great veil out of it, right?
That's right.
Remember what Nancy Najeski did
she
with her
divorced.
Veil?
She got divorced.
I know she got divorced.
All right.
Do you remember what she did with her veil?
No.
You don't remember what you did with her veil?
No.
You have no idea what you did with her veil?
No.
You have no recollection. There's no idea in your mind. You have no memory at all. There's nothing you can ever think of. There's no way you could ever think. There's nothing. She made a planter out of it.
Even when the tone is quieter, the rhythms are different than usual TV sitcom fare. Hunt has enough faith in the material she's written to underplay it, to throw lines away or almost mumble them, when a less secure performer would emphasize them and swing for the fences. Since she lives next door to the Cubs, that's a forgivable cliché. Here she is saying goodbye to her ex-fiancé, who's played by George Clooney. He's dropped by the local bar to let her know he's marrying someone else.
Kathy's pregnant.
Who's the father?
It's funny. He'd make a joke. I just want you to know that I love you and that I have a great respect for you. And I hope that we can always be friends.
Sure.
You okay? And I can go tell the cab to leave.
You know, that'd be great. Just make sure you're in it.
Bonnie Hunt has been in sitcoms before. She was good in NBC's Grand and basically wasted in ABC's Davis Rules. But this is the first show where she really shines, and I think it's because she's playing with her favorite team, on her own show, by her own rules. The Building has a lot of potential, and it's more fun than slick, which is probably why Letterman had no problem putting his name to it. It's got that feel of, hey kids, let's put on a show. And in this case, they've put on a pretty good one.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. And our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, and Ron Barron. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberto Shorrock directs the show. I'm Artie Moskowain.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I will show you around. I love it, bet your bottom dollar you lose the blues in Chicago, Chicago, the town that Billy Sunday couldn't shut down.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
People often tell film director Andrew Davis that their hands go numb when they watch one of his films, from gripping their seat so hard. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director of the movies Under Siege, Code of Silence, and now The Fugitive. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.